Welcome to the July 2023 edition of The Urbanist Live, the podcast produced by the Urban Development Institute of Australia in WA. I'm your host, Tanya Steinbeck, CEO of UDIA WA, and in this episode, I am talking to Samantha Thompson, the newly appointed Managing Director of Taylor Burrell Barnett. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
So for those of you that aren't aware of TBB, they are one of WA's leading urban planners and have recently reached their 50th anniversary a couple of years ago and are one of the longest standing in the industry. TBB has a strong connection with UDIA WA, being one of our inaugural members. And given we are looking back at the impact that UDIA has made over the last 50 years, we thought it would be a great opportunity to talk about how much the industry has changed and what the future might look like for WA. So I'm going to kick off with that question that everybody hates, which means you have to talk about yourself. So firstly, Sam, can you just share with the listeners a little bit about yourself and what taking over from Lex at TBB has meant to you?
Okay, thanks, Tanya. I'm pleased to be here. Yeah, look, I joined TBB in March 1992 and had the privilege to work alongside pioneers of the industry in the early days, Bill Burrell and Russell Taylor, the founding partners of TBB, and Alan Blood, who is well known to the industry. David Lawn and Ian Everett joined at the same time about that I did. So 31 years later, here I am, still there. So obviously I have very big shoes to fill in terms of replacing Lex in the MD role. I've always known that my professional career would be with TBB, but never had really targeted all about the managing director's position as such. Lex's succession is something that we've been planning for a number of years, and I guess my appointment just evolved from that discussion. I've always felt comfortable in leadership roles, which is evident in the kind of multidisciplinary project teams I've led, and you know, some of which have been quite significant. And this motivated me to complete the AICD company director course last year, which was quite significant, probably bigger than I thought it was going to be at the time, but really glad that I completed that. And then it was really a natural progression to step into this role. And then from there, it was logical for Rachel to lead the planning team and Ben to lead the design team as the two other directors that will share this journey with me moving forward.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, extremely humbled and inspired by the support and encouragement that I've received from Rachel and Ben, but also the rest of the TBB team and industry peers. I've had a lot of positive feedback, which is it's really been quite humbling and probably given me a little bit more confidence than I probably had going into the process. It's a huge responsibility and I've got a lot to learn, but I'm very much looking forward to it.
I think it's fantastic that we are seeing more female leaders step into these roles. What do you think the key differences are between the role that you were undertaking previously and now being in charge? What are the key skills that are sort of required to make that transition?
Look, I think that, you know, there are four partners in the business and we've always all had an individual role. And we've always been joint decision makers in as a director group. So we've always worked really quite closely and strongly together. And I suppose really we just needed to take a step back and look at what we felt the future business might have needed. And so along with me being appointed as managing director, we've also brought in a general manager and that the whole shift in the business has been more so that Rachel, Ben and I can work more on the business, and Joanne Tansey, our general manager, she's going to be taking over the operations side of the business under my supervision, I suppose. So yeah, it's we're probably, you know, as a director group, we're working together in much the same way, but we're more looking forward to working on the business and working more on projects and really leaving that administrative side to the GM to fulfill. So
well, it's a fantastic freedom, I think, that you get when you can work on the business rather than in the business.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people, I think, find it challenging to make that transition to leave the operational behind and let somebody else take that on and have that separation between those two things.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, the team that Jo has working with her, you know, we've got people and culture, we've got graphic design, we've got marketing, and finance. So we've got a really good group of people, and you know, we've been working together over the last few years and putting all of this in place to allow this to happen, and we've got really good systems and reporting lines available so that it really gives us the confidence and the comfort to do the things that we really enjoy doing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in terms of the 50th anniversary, which is obviously our anniversary of UDIA this year and TBB recently, how do you think that the Perth urban landscape has changed over the last few decades?
Congratulations first.
Well, thank you.
It was really interesting and quite a bit scary actually, looking back at, I suppose, my 31 years and what had happened in that time. And really the development landscape was relatively less complex. There was quite a proactive approach from applicants and approval agencies to facilitate outcomes, and the approval framework was a lot more streamlined. Obviously, it's a lot more complex and time-consuming now. But I look back at some of the projects, and the Joondalup City Centre was in its early stages. The freeway had reached Ocean Reef Road in the north and Thomas Road in the south.
Wow.
Urban development along the freeway was only really up to Berrigan Drive and Burns Beach Road in the north. The railway line to Joondalup had occurred, and the Mandurah railway line opened in 2007, and the freeway, Cronulla Freeway to Mandurah, just a short time afterwards. So, you know, in the early part of my career, urban growth was strongly focused around large scale greenfield master plan communities, like 3,000 lotters.
Yeah,
you know,
huge.
Unheard of today, all on the fringes. Allenbrook was just starting to develop and was really seen as quite a remote outpost in those days. The Northeast Corridor was really just in the early phases of planning. So, you know, developments like Ascot Waters and Claysbrook in the early 90s were watersheds in urban renewal for Perth, and, you know, were really the first time we saw large-scale brownfield developments occurring. And it was really a start of an era change, and was promptly followed by a major government policy reform in the form of the WA Community Design Codes, which I was really fortunate enough to be a part of the team who developed that and later saw, you know, that evolve into livable neighbourhoods, and how I've been lucky enough to be involved in subsequent reviews in more recent times. So, you know, as I said, planning has become increasingly more complex and time-consuming as a result of, you know, new urban development being planned in highly fragmented and more constrained land on the fringes. It's a very different time.
It is indeed, and I was reflecting on this with one of our members a couple of weeks ago who had done a major land development in Canning Vale, and this is going back to the 90s, and the subdivision had, I think, four or five conditions, and today the equivalent subdivision would have, you know, meant 30, 40 subdivision conditions on it. And we were wondering if the outcomes, the ultimate outcome for those residents that are living in that development in Canning Vale, is any better than the outcomes of those developments that are being produced now with those 40 odd subdivision conditions.
I would say not.
Isn't it? Yeah. And it's a fascinating way to look at it, I think, because ultimately, I think at the end of the day, we do in this industry is provide people with great places. And and so are all of these well-intended policies and requirements ultimately improving the outcome for those people that are living there? And yeah, it's an interesting debate to have.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of times when you engage with government and talking about, you know, the changes that they make for these reasons, it's always about protecting or catering for the lowest common denominator. Yes, but, you know, we know that all developers in, you know, in the industry are well-intended and will, you know, achieve the right outcomes, but we have to put these things in place because there might be the one who isn't, and we have to make sure that we get the right outcome. So it's really quite frustrating. And similarly, I was thinking back to the time when, you know, we could just change lots. You know, we had a subdivision approval and we needed to adjust the lots through the pre-cal stages. We didn't need to lodge a revised plan or an amended plan.
Yeah, you had the flexibility.
More flexibility, and we can have a conversation with an officer and say, oh, look, you know, this is the issue, this is why, and they're like, yeah, no trouble. You didn't have to worry about dealing with it at a deposited plan. Mm. There was a lot more pragmatic, so bureaucracy's gone a little bit mad.
And so thinking about, you know, all of that change that you were just mentioning there and some quite iconic milestones in terms of Perth development, what do you think the most defining project has been or the most defining change within that length of time?
Oh, it's interesting because I looked back at some of the projects that I had been involved in and, you know, extremely fortunate to have worked alongside Bill Burrell for so long on so many projects and, you know, with Ben DeMarkey as well in the office and, you know, thinking back about Perth City Link, you know, a project that saw the undergrounding of the railway and connecting Northbridge to the city centre, and Mandra Ocean Marina, which, you know, was iconic in that it saw the introduction of Venetian waterways, which were the first in Australia, hadn't been done anywhere.
Wow.
And that ended up winning the Jack Nicol International Marina of the Year Award, which was the first time a project in Australia had won, like that. Ascot Waters Marina, which was a state and federal government collaboration funded through the Better Cities program. So each of these projects had little, you know, different intricacies associated with them that we probably don't see a lot of anymore. And the things like the village at Wellard, which was Pete's project and a JV with communities, you know, that was a collaboration with state government to get that station delivered so that we could create I think Perth's first true walkable Todd.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I suppose the biggest one for me was the community design codes and what is now livable neighbourhood. And as I said, it was internationally recognised as one of the most innovative and comprehensive regulating documents for shaping sustainable and livable outcomes for urban development, and receiving the International Congress for New Urbanism Charter Award in 2000. It also saw the introduction of local development plans, you know, which we've come to appreciate and an incredibly valuable tool. But I think, you know, more recently there's other things like the introduction of the development assessment panels, which I was fortunate enough to be a presiding member for a couple of years, and our office continues to support with three members. And I think more recently, the collaborative framework that was provided through the significant development assessment pathway, you know, them bringing all of the agencies together through that pathway, you know, has achieved some incredible results. And, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned with a number of those projects and a number of the processes that they saw that resulted in, you know, some fantastic and different outcomes.
Yeah, well, and I think quite timely, you know, the mention of the SDAU, where yesterday we saw the approval of the Children's Hospice project in Swanbourne, and what a fantastic outcome. And I think that demonstrates the value of having a mechanism or an approval pathway like the SDAU.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great outcome. So obviously a lot has changed. Is there any, I guess if you could go back in time, what would you do differently? You know, if you were considering the way that Perth has evolved and developed over time, we get a lot of criticism around how Perth is so long, and obviously taking advantage of the coast and that lovely word or term urban sprawl. Would you have developed Perth any differently?
Look, I think if we had of probably re-looked at the Gordon Stevenson plan early enough, we could have maintained the urban corridors but created more village-like responses within them.
Yeah.
You know, picking up on some of the European settlement patterns, I think, you know, Perth was probably ripe for things like that happening. You know, in the earlier days, there was always this green wedge between Rockingham and Mandra, and, you know, the local governments, you know, held that fiercely for so long, and unfortunately it's dissipated over time. But I think there is a lot to be said for, you know, that kind of urban development outcome. And I think when we look at the planning trends now for, you know, concentrations of intensity around nodes and, you know, centres and transport nodes, it's that really, if we had have captured that earlier on. And then I think that, you know, the couple of other areas that I had identified was really how we've dealt with housing diversity. I think that, you know, we have very homogenous suburbs now, and I think it's a real, really lost opportunity that we haven't created more diverse housing.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at the average household size now, today it's, I think, 2.48. And if you have a look at some of the household couples with children represent about 30% of our population, and 25% are couples without children. 59% of our households are 1- and 2-person households.
Yeah.
And yet we're creating 4x2 and 3x2 homes. You know, our lots are getting smaller, our homes are getting bigger. And I think there's housing diversity is a huge opportunity for our industry. And I think increasing density isn't just about smaller lots, it's about smaller homes. And I think there's a clear mismatch between the households that people need and the products that we're delivering, or and even a need for greater education of the community, because I think that it has an impact on sustainability. You know, I've had discussions with some local governments who think that just because you create an R40 lot, it has to accommodate a two-storey home. So we don't need a bigger home. We need a smaller home on a smaller lot.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that's a huge opportunity for us. I think we need to think about diversity, not just in the inner metropolitan areas, but also in the corridors, and increase diversity in the suburbs. As I say, they've become very homogenous. And I think livable neighbourhoods promotes a return to traditional neighbourhood design and greater diversity, and therefore increased population to support that. Traditional mixed-use neighbourhood is something that I'd like to see evolve more over time.
Yeah, fantastic. And so following on from that, what's your thoughts for the future of the development industry and you know, obviously planning being a critical part of that? What's some of the biggest challenges and opportunities that you think are facing both planners and developers over the next 12 months?
Look, I think there's a lot happening in planning reform. You know, new legislation, we've got the medium density codes, the public open space policy and the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Act, to name a few, that have all really come out at the same time. You know, we've got transition periods to deal with, and you know, we're really supportive of the intent of both the MDCs and the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage, as is everyone in the industry. But a lot of the time, the devil is in the details. So TBB has been working closely with our clients since the MDC's release to really understand the implications of the transition period, particularly between what that means between now and September 2025. And at the same time, we've been collaborating with the housing industry to consider the implications on the housing topologies and alignment with our lot typologies. And then we have to unpack that and see what it means for our planning approvals. The POS policy is another matter. And I think we would have all liked to have seen a lot more consultation with industry during its formulation phase. But I think on the positive, I think the consultation period represents an opportunity for us to work with policymakers and local government to understand what the key issues are and try and collaborate on suitable solutions. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be done in that space. And I hope moving forward that there is a lot more collaboration, because I don't think it's government's problem alone to solve these problems.
Yeah.
You know, the development industry has a lot of intelligence in these areas and a lot to offer. And, you know, we're working with local governments every day. So
yeah,
I think there's a strong message to work with us to assist in facilitating those outcomes.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. Ultimately, we're all working towards the same aim. Sometimes we see the journey towards that aim slightly differently, but ultimately we're trying to achieve the same thing. So, yeah, absolutely working in partnership with other sectors, I think, is really important.
And I suppose from a TBB's perspective, we've also seen ourselves as representing the end user, the community. You know, we've got a social responsibility to be there. So we've got to balance the views of all of the parties and achieving those equitable outcomes.
Yeah, and look, I think...
And affordable outcomes.
Indeed. And I think the social, you know, that social license to operate and the whole ESG conversation that has become so significant now is really going to have a significant impact on how we create the communities of the future. So, you know, thinking forward 20, 30, even 50 years time, what do you think our industry might look like, taking into account that, I guess, increased desire for the principles of ESG, responding to climate change, the evolution of artificial intelligence and technology? What do you think that Perth will look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose with my role in livable neighbourhoods and its formulation, you know, that was really formulated on the principles of sustainability. You know, it's about clusters of walkable neighbourhoods to create, you know, town centres that are the walkable and, you know, protecting the environmental assets and all of those kinds of things. And so a lot of the policy framework from that livable neighbourhoods represents is there. And I think I'd like to see, and I'd hope that the framework that livable neighbourhoods has provided will provide for the communities that we've created now to be able to evolve over time, to mature, to intensify, to increase in density and intensity and provide the diversity of housing, to get the likes of Subiaco and North Perth happening in the growth corridors in 20 and 30 and 40 years' time. So I hope that the policies evolve to allow that to happen. I think that the bones of it are there, and I think that the policy needs to mature to facilitate those outcomes. I'd hate to see that those suburbs and communities remain homogenous lots that they are now. I think that retail trends are changing. You know, we've got retail centres are created as more entertainment precincts now, and you know, that whole world's changing. But I'd like to see that a lot of that entertainment and those communities and hearts are brought back into those places so that people can live and work close to home. And so I think there's a real opportunity to get that kind of traditional neighbourhood occurring in the suburbs. So that's what I'd like to see. But I think at a more strategic level, when you take a step back and you think about, you know, Perth being the 12th most livable city in the world, Australia's most affordable city, got $29 billion of state government projects over the next couple of years, $148 billion of projects under development in the resource pipeline, 50,000 people immigrated to WA in the last 12 months, and 75,000 migrants set to come into WA over the next couple of years. I just feel like, and we've got a housing crisis.
Yeah, where are they going to go?
It just feels like we're not taking advantage of the opportunity that this presents us. So I think at the conference it was asked of us by one of the speakers, what is the vision for Perth? And I think we acknowledge that we have Perth and Peel, and as a residential or a framework, it's a reasonable foundation. But I think there's something missing that brings together a vision that articulates how we're going to position Perth as a future livable, smart, connected, knowledge and innovation, innovative city for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, as a gateway to the Asia Pacific, and with the mining and the resource and with technology, I just feel like there's a missing piece. And how can we create a comprehensive whole of government approach that aligns a vision for the community and government and the private sector to have real clarity about what that means, not just for housing,
yes,
but for innovation precincts and for employment and, you know, Westport, you know, all of these things, bringing it together, a clear vision and moving beyond Metronet. You know, what is the next public transport opportunity? You know, there's been a lot of discussion about that. So I think we know change is inevitable, and we know that, you know, as at the conference, the future has said it happens at an exponential rate of change and it's unpredictable. But I think we need a blueprint that provides us a real foundation to what this bigger picture Perth really could be, because our communities are much more than the spatial two-dimensional spaces that we live in. They're virtual now. So, yeah, it's exciting, but I think it's a little bit, it's a missed opportunity that we're not positioned for that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think within that blueprint that we need, it needs to be adaptable and flexible and agile, because the reality is, I mean, a lot of us don't know how things are going to play out over the next 30, 40 years with the speed of change in particular and technology, that whatever we do and whatever framework or blueprint we provide, that the vision is holistic and future focused enough to provide that flexibility to adapt and respond as the environment changes. Right. Well, before we finish, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for sharing your time with us today. We always ask our guests to give us a message in the bottle for our listeners that are at home or at work. So what would your message in a bottle be for those that are listening?
Look, I think continuing with the theme, I think it's time to embrace innovation and technology while preserving our cultural heritage and our natural assets. No topical at the moment. And I think we need to strive for a balance between progress and preservation to create a city that is both forward thinking and respectful of our unique identity. You know, we live in a beautiful city.
Oh,
and I think
yes, amazing.
Yeah, I think it's time.
Yeah. No, I love that quote, the balance between progress and preservation. It's such a key outcome that we're looking to see, particularly in the way that government prepares and designs public policy and planning policy in particular. It's how do you strike that balance between the two? It's very tricky. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time again today. It's been great chatting to you. And thank you very much for listening in. I hope that our chat today has provided you with some information that either inspires you or assists you in your business. And congratulations once again, Sam, and to the rest of the TBB team on taking over the reins.
Stay tuned for more episodes of The Urbanist Live, sharing property market and urban development industry insights with our listeners over the coming months.